Yeah, so after I've done that, after I've shown you that, I'm going to end with a discussion. Yeah, so let's dive right in. So I'm going to just say a bunch of things which are reasonably non-controversial, but so maybe the application to this particular problem, which is classicality in quantum mechanics, is controversial. The physics that I present before is clearly not. So let's start with the first part, which is, let me move the mouse cursor away there. With the concept of classicality. So let's look at a simple example. So what I want to look at is the quantum Ising model. So for some large n, the Hilbert space of this system is C2, this is a tensor product of n C2s. The Hamiltonian would look like this, where these are the Pauli matrices. So we have a bunch of spins on a line or in a 2D lattice. Doesn't matter what I'm saying right now. And then what I want to do is I want to look how this system behaves when I change the temperature. And as is well known, there's a critical temperature at which the system is radically different. The behavior of the system radically changes. So one way to see that is if you look at the free energy, this has these two parts, the energy itself, and then this part containing the entropy. So if the temperature is high, you expect that this part is the dominant one. So you want a high entropy, which means that you have a phase which is not ordered. As you lower the temperature, this part becomes more and more important, and you get you get the phase transition, and the spins all the line. So once you go with temperature past the critical, you enter an ordered phase, and the direction. So in the spin model, we get this ordered phase is derived by some order parameter, which in the spin model we can think of as some theta, which is sort of the direction of the velocity of the point. So that's what describes this new phase after we've lowered the temperature. So there's one more thing which is sort of central to what I want to say, which is that this ordered phase is a new property, which people call generalized rigidity. Generalized because rigidity is what we call things like the fact that if I knock on this table, then it knocks back. if I knock at the spins, then they don't want to move. They want to stay in this phase that I had before. So the way one can see that is if one varies theta, the free energy resists that, and that's sort of the generalized force. Which is non-zero, and this is what people in solid-state physics call generalized rigidity. So the system, if you want, wants to protect this property, this direction theta zero. So this is one of the key properties of this ordered phase that I want to bring your attention to. So now let's think about why that could be important. So imagine now that you have two systems like that, right? Imagine that you have two systems, two spin systems. Oops. Oops. Sorry. How did that happen? Sorry. I don't know how that. Imagine that you have two systems like that. One which has this order parameter theta 1, and the other which has the order parameter theta 2, and they interact. Then both of these generalized rigidity, so they both want to sort of defend this position of the order parameter. So an interaction that would then best be described by a term like that, which uses the order parameter itself. to describe the interaction. What I'm saying here is that if I have objects like that with these properties, then it's these properties that are important when I describe the interaction. So another example that you could think of is this table where the order parameter is the position of the lattice, and this is sort of another lattice of that kind. And when I hit the table with this thing, what I'm basically doing is I'm checking one order parameter if you want with the other one. So what I want to say is that so these are quantum systems. So these are two quantum systems, and it's the fact that they show this property of generalized rigidity which makes theta an objective property. Right? So you can take the hockey stick, I can take a hockey stick, anybody can take a hockey stick and can probe what that property is. Right? So that brings me to this might be the controversial part, is that I call this property, because of this fact that it has this this objective quality that we all can go around, we can test it, check a classical property. So there's if I want to vary it, the system sort of pushes back. And the key point here is this one, that classicality in this way then becomes a dynamical property of a large quantum system. Okay, so let's compare that with the sort of old concept, if you want, or the other concept. And that is radically different, because usually we know a priori what the meaning of classicality is. So if we write down a state, something like this, in a superposition like this, then usually what we do is we have sort of an understanding what these I's, in this case, what these I's mean. So either we write down an expansion in a basis of position operators, and then we say this is the position of something, or we say this is up or down. So we have we start with the classical notion already sort of built into our quantum world, and I think that this is sort of very peculiar if you do that, right? So if you have this a priori notion of classicality built into your quantum mechanics, then immediately you find this question, which is how does psi assume one of these classical states, right? So immediately if you do this, then you immediately end up with a measurement problem. There's no way around it. Right? You have to ask yourself, well, why does it end up with these things? So, and I think, I mean, it's also ontologically sort of funny, right? If you think that the world is ultimately quantum mechanical, then how is it that the classical theory that is supposed to be some sort of limit of the quantum theory is a priori sort of built in already into the more fundamental theory? I always found that very confusing. So,
Excuse me. Why do you say that classical to be in one or the other with it just because you're calling it up or down? What if you just call it plus or minus? Would it make it?
Well, because I mean, we always have sort of some mean. I mean, it was just an example that I was using there. But there's sort of a classical meaning that we attribute to that thing already at that stage.
I still didn't get it. Why you call these vector states classical states?
Because I mean, usually, so maybe if you call them classical, because you attribute some meaning to this label that you put there. So if you do an expansion sort of in a position basis or something like that, an X basis, then you say that this is the position of the particle. You have an a priori understanding of what that X that labels your state, what that X means, right? It's a priori there before you. It's not coming sort of after you analyze the quantum theory. You sort of go back. It's there before, right? So I mean, the point is, of course, that this is because we quantize. We came to quantum theory by quantizing classical systems. You might simply ask the question, given a classical system, what is a quantum theory? And then the procedure we have is sort of put hats over everything, right? And that implies sort of that you, what you do to get to the quantum theory is that you put in the classical notions in the construction, sort of into the quantum theory. So let's compare these two notions. So this classical classicality is this what we all know, and this what I so in here the classicality becomes a property of a quantum system. So that this we just discussed sort of classical. There's a classical meaning to states a priori in the classical classicality. Here there's none. Often you have so this up-down thing or something, you have a basis of classical states, and then the question is, why does it get into one of them? So here, yes, you have a basis, no, generally not. Classical states are, in the classical case, they are completely kinematical. Right? You don't have to look at any Hamiltonian or anything. You know the classical states. And here, it's a completely dynamical question. There will be no knowledge of quantum classicality if you don't have the Hamiltonian of the system. The Hamiltonian is sort of all important.
Excuse me. Sorry to interrupt.
No, sure.
Can I give a sort of what seems to be like a counterexample to that? We understand particle physics as an elementary particles as irreducible representations of a certain symmetry group.
Right.
That's completely kinematical.
Good. So. Right, so the point is that I would say, and I'm coming back to that in my spiel on gravity, where I'm saying that this whole thing is insane, right? This way of looking at it is insane. So yes, that's fine. You can do that, and you, I mean it's very. It wouldn't be so prevalent if it weren't so successful, right? I mean there's some you have to work a bit to do that, but. I think it's wrong. It's ultimately the wrong way. And this is maybe we can come back when I discuss sort of what I call internal relativity, where particles and symmetries cannot be sort of so neatly distinguished as in that case. So let's come back.
The second point. Why is it going to have basis? It's because it's not complete, is that the because a different order parameter did label different states.
Yeah, but I mean if you think about so how would you do it in the spin chain? What you're saying is that you take all the different for the different data. But then how would you get the ones where they're sort of all
okay,
weird?
So it's not complete.
Right. That's the point. So in the definition is this point here that classical states they push back. So since they're completely kinematical, that's not even, I don't even know what that means here. And this is sort of the definition, if you want, of this thing. And if you think about something like that, then you immediately sort of get a you think about twice about sort of quantization being your main route into the quantum theory. Right, so if you, so in class, because if you do quantization, then this is how you end up. You end up with these kinematical states, which are your supposed classical states. And in the quantum classicality system, if you think about the spin chain, what would quantization do? What would it do for you there? That is sort of that is sort of the main point is this. And one thing that I want to now sort of point out is that that randomness is automatically part of this thing. Randomness you cannot get rid of that. But another thing is also that it says something about gravity, and that's sort of more interesting, and that's the only new formula
I'm just wondering, are you going to go into more detail on precisely what I mean by this pushing back the rigidity?
Yeah, so...
Because at this point, I'm still not clear on precisely what's meant.
Yeah, maybe at the end we can sort of... Because I'm also veering off in some other direction, maybe you can... Okay, so let me go to this to the randomness part. So let's look at the transition again, this thing. So the transition happens when I decrease the temperature. So as I decrease the temperature at some point, I'm crossing this this critical temperature. And so where I had no distinguished direction before, I have one afterwards. So there's sort of this very discontinuous transition. So let's see if we can analyze it a bit more closely. So add a term in the Hamiltonian, which is of this form. So just sort of a Hamiltonian, a magnetic field in the z direction. Then this curve that I just showed you can be sort of obtained if you do this calculation here. So you calculate the magnetization, let n go to infinity, and then let h go to zero. And one way of seeing sort of, if you look at this last limit here, is to see that that if you just get close enough to the critical temperature, this system becomes arbitrarily sensitive to the environment. So what I want to do is I want you to sort of think of this thing as some perturbation by the environment. So as you get closer and closer to critical, the system itself becomes very much very sensitive to the environment. So in sort of an analog example, sort of an analog picture that you could have is that before you have this order parameter, as you get closer and closer, the system looks sort of like a classical system like this one, where you sort of balance a ball on a sort of in this metastable situation. It becomes arbitrarily sensitive to the environment in this case. So this is this point, and the claim is that if you agree that this is what classicality is in quantum mechanics, then you immediately see that then it will automatically be there will automatically be this probabilistic element in it. Right? Because the transition in this transition that you make from this unordered to this ordered state, you will pass this point where you're extremely sensitive to the environment. So and this has of course so if you think about it that usually the way you phrase the measurement problem is that you have some sort of small system plus some measuring apparatus. And they go, as you measure the system, you go into sort of some state of the big system. Then if you get a linear combination of that, then you should get a linear system, linear superposition of the system. And why is that not the end of the story? And it's not the end of the story because this big system here, which is one of the systems that undergoes this phase transition, when you do the measurement, becomes extremely sensitive to the environment. And so this sort of simple-minded linearity doesn't apply. You can't do this in this case when you have a system that undergoes some transition like that. Another point is that you might. Another objection that you might have is that, well, surely the environment must be symmetric. Right? Otherwise, what would the measurement mean if the environment is non-symmetric and sort of decides the measurement outcome? But the point is that yes, it is symmetric, but it is only symmetric in some sort of ergodic way, in some ergodic sense. So instead of let this be sort of let this G be some element of your whatever symmetry you have, then this will in general be not true. Right, so if you just take some environment state at some given time, then that will not hold. What will hold, though, is if you average over some long enough time, then this G will not do anything to this average. So what I'm saying is that it is these non-symmetric fluctuations that are amplified by this by this process that you have. Right. Another question. Oh, sorry.
So in talk about you argue that at the phase transition,
yeah,
a system like this spin chamber, for instance, is going to be very sensitive to the environment.
Right.
And then when it seemed like you were arguing that that can explain the way that quantum measurement devices seem to choose which state to collapse into, this probabilistic quantum mechanics. But why, I mean, if I have a quantum measurement process, where do I go through a phase transition?
So I mean, so if you take, if you want an example or something like that, right, of a system where you, so I mean, one thing I could do with that is so in this to just use the spin chain, right? I just think of the sort of the first spin as the system that I'm measuring, mm-hmm. and the rest of the spin is my apparatus.
Okay.
Right. And what I do is I do this kind of transition.
But there are, I mean, what. If you're going to explain the probabilistic nature of quantum mechanics using yeah. this phase transition thing, then I think you have to show that every time we see probabilistic things happen in quantum mechanics, there's a phase transition happening.
Right.
And
right.
I mean, if I go out there and I use a photodetector to detect a photon, I'm not. Is there a phase transition I'm missing there? I mean, does this apply somehow to every measurement apparatus?
Yeah. So good. So. In the way I presented it here, it's sort of almost by definition, because I use sort of classical things, which are the outcomes of these measurements, to be of this type that we always get something that pushes back. If you think about something like a cloud chamber or something like that, you maybe see this element of the transition more clearly, right? This formation of these bubbles is something of that type. The Geiger counter that you have, that you mentioned, is a bit more tricky, and I'm not quite sure if that immediately sort of fits in this framework without sort of modification. I mean, what you have there too is this system that you make sort of very sensitive to this cascade of photons and electron pairs that you use. So to get this amplification factor that you need to make that happen, right? So it's a bit more tricky to analyze it in that case. I think it's pretty clear sort of in the bubble chamber thing, but it's a bit trickier in that case.
Excuse me, can I perhaps just try to, in the context of measurement, if you try to understand it this way, that there's no unitary evolution that's going to lead to the collapse of the wave packet. You always have to couple the system to a big reservoir or something
right.
and take a t going to infinity limit or something like that to observe that. So that's probably the analog. In other words, you have to bring in something which is macroscopic
so right.
to make that happen.
Right, that's right.
To that extent, you need something classical to observe the quantum relativity.
But why do you say that?
Excuse me?
Why classical? Just big is my point, not classical.
Well, okay, big may not necessarily mean classical, but you need a big reservoir. Okay?
Yeah,
you need an infinite heat bars or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, 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 right. So, but the point is that, I mean, the whole point of this is that it's big, not classical. It's big,
okay, fine.
Right? And the point, yeah. Sorry. Right, so then you could ask, okay, well, that's fine, but can you say something about the quantum, right, which is something that you need to come up with, because usually these coefficients in the expansion of any wave function, they have a meaning for us, namely that the square of them gives me the probability to measure that thing in that certain, and I'm not going into the details here, so what I did in this paper that I cited down here is that I took arguments that originally were developed by David Deutsch and then extended by Wallace, extended by Wallace and then stripped sort of all this many worlds stuff by Simon Saunders. That, I mean, in many words, they have this problem, right? They need to come up with some way to explain the Born rule, this fact here. And David Deutsch came up with a very sort of impressive work. And then Simon Saunders made some remarks saying that this has not really anything to do with many worlds. And I adopted this kind of thinking. So basically I'm saying that I'm using the fact that if your Hamiltonian has a certain symmetry, I'm saying that in some sense the environment should have similar symmetries, and then you can derive this. Okay, so.
But you now have all the charges of circularity against all these proofs, also by Zurek, earlier ones. There's an enormous body of literature answering to these, they're attached for.
Enormous?
Well, as big as the original literature.
Right, I mean, so. No, okay, so I mean, is that. No, I'm not quite. I guess I'm not quite. So the point is there that you say that, okay, you get, if you assume some sort of Hilbert space formalism, then these probability rules are sort of put in. Is that sort of the gist of the thing, or is that the circularity?
No, that's not the charge. The charge of circularity, maybe that probabilistic arguments are already put in, because these authors claim to be right.
No, I mean, okay, so the point is that you have to look into the details. So there's one thing so if you take an example, the jury Wojciech's thing, right? Which is, I think that is just obviously sort of pulling a rabbit out of the hat, right? Because he sort of says that certain the sort of what the probability is a property of some state, if you want. But then the question becomes of course immediately why probabilities, right? And is that the circularity that you're speaking of?
No, this is going to be a long discussion.
Okay, sorry. Okay, so maybe later. Because there I can sort of see that. Because, I mean, here at least I'll show you the details, and then we can talk about that. So the last part is gravity. So the thing that I'm talking about is the general setup is some system, some spin system, three-dimensional, say. I'm sticking to spins, some nets like that one. So Ising Mellow plus modification, or much more interesting, on the string net condensates that when sort of work. So these are solid state. This is solid state physicist. So, but it's sort of very, very, very down to earth. It's a normal Hamiltonian and normal spin system, quantum system like. I'm having all these things that you usually wouldn't expect when you think about sort of gravity less, even less than you think about quantum gravity. So how could this have anything to do with gravity? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to sort of introduce two levels. So the first level, the zeros level, is the system has a ground state, and let's say again it's characterized by some order parameter. So this is the vacuum. The next level then is some sort of set of excitations. So that's the usual behavior of sort of many body systems. You have some ground state, and then the sort of interesting physics then happens for the excitations. So if you think about so this 1D Ising model, you could actually write down what these excitations are, so you get these traveling wave modes and you get some dependence of the energy on that K. So, but we don't need to go into the details. So these would be what corresponds to the elementary particles in our systems. So we have the vacuum, if you want, then the set of excitations of that vacuum are what we would call elementary particles. And the only thing is that to remember is that where the excitations are, so excitations are essentially deviations of the vacuum from this theta zero value. So you can think of the traveling spin waves as sort of wiggling order parameters, if you want. And the last level is, that's a very instructive picture, sorry, is then you take or classical object, that's where you do your slides for the evening. Sorry. So what I mean by that is sort of, so now we take a classical object, which in this case would be a bound state of these excitations. So this blob is the excitations that which have some interactions among them. And then we think we want to look at a classical object that is some bound object, like, I don't know, what we talked about before, like some table, something. Right, so we have these these three levels, right? So we have the ground state, and we have excitations, which are sort of our elementary particles, and then we have classical states made out of these elementary particles by binding them together. So the point is here that if you have a classical object like this one, then because the excitations are essentially deviations of the vacuum from this theta zero value, then around this classical object, theta will not be like this one, will not be the ground state value. So this is the one formula here. So let's see what that means if we are in a situation where things are not moving too fast. Things are sort of moving very slowly. Right? So we can sort of use approximations where everything is essentially static, right? So nothing moves fast. So generically in the Hamiltonian of the system, the energy will depend, so the energy will depend sort of, it will have a contribution like this one, which is essentially the thing that makes modes propagate. So there's going to be some term like that, and this is a very generic behavior that you will find for these kind of symmetry states. So if you vary that thing, then if there's nothing around, then you will get this Laplace equation here. And so if there's no object, no nothing, then this theta will satisfy a Laplace equation. And now what I want you to look at is sort of squint your eyes and think about first semester electrostatic. So, and you replace sort of theta with the electric potential, and nabla theta is in the electric field. And then what this is the field, the energy in the electric field, and this is just a Poisson equation. And we know what the solution to that thing is when you want to do that. So if we have two objects, like two classical blobs like this one, then there will be, so since they disturb the vacuum, as I said before, then there will be some force between them, which is proportional to these, suggestively called M1 and M2. And this is just this. So if you, in the electrostatic example, this would be just the charge. And I'm just calling this M here, because of course I want to call this mass. Right? So I can see that just being classical in this kind of setup means that you disturb the vacuum, and that leads to the fact that you will have some sort of attraction between these things. So I call this viewpoint, I call this internal relativity. There are other people who call it physical relativity or something. So basically what you're asking is the question, how does such a system look from the inside? So you think you are, and one observer made out of these excitations in the system. And then what you would, so I'm not going into the details here, but if you have a system where the excitations are, so have a linear dispersion, then the metric that you will find, if you sort of define the metric internally, is Lorentzian. And what I just showed you is that in this low speed limit, you will get some sort of Newtonian gravity. So not only will the metric be Lorentzian, but the metric will also be curved. So naturally, so if you want to have a system like that, you will naturally find something like curvature in your system. Okay, so let me discuss some things. So what I wanted to, the main point maybe is this one, that it is this thing that we do, which is that we sort of a priori put the classical world into the quantum kinematics, leads to the measurement problem. That's my main point. And instead, what I want to do is I want to say that classicality is a dynamic property of a large quantum system. That's sort of the main thing. So one thing that follows from would be that is that don't quantize. So what does that mean? So usually what we have is we assume that the following circle is sort of closed. So you have some fundamental quantum theory, you look at the classical limit that gives you the classical theory, which is the theory that we first discovered historically, and then by some miracle that we quantize that classical theory, and we end up again with the fundamental theory. So that's sort of the way a lot of our theories are built, and we hope sort of that this circle closes. And if what I'm saying is correct, then this circle will not close. The fundamental theory, this bunch of spins or whatever you have, you won't get by quantizing the effective theory that you saw in this sort of classical limit. So what you do instead is you do something where you start with a completely quantum theory, which could be something like the theory that I described to you, like this Wendt model, or you can get some theory by Pavlovic, which is another solid state physicist. So you start from the beginning with a quantum theory, no quantization, and then you ask, well, what do I get? Do I get something out of that? Just a short remark, maybe, on the roles of the environment. So the role of the environment in this, sorry, some water, I guess. And in the roles of the environment in this setup is sort of threefold. On top of what sort of people in decoherence sort of realize or notice is, so one is when you do this transition, you need to dump some energy and entropy somewhere, but you also need the environment to bring close to this transition point. And then the key point that I was arguing for is that the environment provides the randomness. So randomness in quantum mechanics would be the same kind of randomness that we have somewhere else in physics, namely lack of knowledge. We don't know what the state of the environment is. So and then the role of the coherence would then be to just keep it classical. What would I say? Yeah, so gravity, so the role of gravity, we have gravity because essentially because we sort of have these two levels on top of the ground state, which means that you get this disturbance of the vacuum that we see as gravity. And there's one part which I don't quite see how that works. But so this is sort of my open problem right now, which is that I actually have to show you that it's gravity. And what does that mean? What I have to show you is that the inertial mass is the same as the gravitational mass. So I sort of argued that I have an expression for a gravitational mass. But now what I need to do is I need to verify the equivalence principle. Right, so I need to say that for some reason, which I unfortunately can't tell you right now, is that if I ask the question, what is the inertial mass of one of these classical blobs, I end up with the same expression. Right, because only then is it actually fair to say that this is gravity. Right, so my rant here. Thanks.
Interpret classicality in this sense in terms of a large mass or large number of particles in the system. But one also tries to understand the quantum classical transition process in single particle terms. And there's this whole theory of quantization and dequantization. The feeling in some sense is, to put it picturesquely, is that the ghost of the quantum theory sort of hovers over the classical remains. And so when you quantize a theory, you're sort of incarnating this ghost, okay? And when you dequantize it, you're sort of exercising this ghost. But I mean, but on the other hand, I mean, one does it for a single system. You see, certain symmetries of nature hold both at the classical level and at the quantum level. Rotational symmetry, time symmetry, energy conservation, the kinematical symmetries, okay? So in that sense, it does not seem to be necessary to invoke this transition to enlarged systems to really define classicality. You see, this whole theory, a lot of people, including Professor Lanzmann behind me, have spent years and years studying this transition from classical to quantum mechanics, and that's not necessarily within the context of large systems. That's within the context of single particle systems, for example.
Yeah, and yeah. Right, so I guess my point would be that you shouldn't do that. But And then I make that.
Who shouldn't do that? You or we?
Well, I won't do it, but no, I don't know. I mean, look, if you want, take it as a question. Why not like this? If you want. And I mean, for me, this is sort of. I thought I got interested in this because of the viewpoint it puts on gravity. Right, so one thing is that, so there are a couple of points. One is that don't quantize, so you don't start by trying to come up with a Hilbert space L2 of some sort of set of metrics, which seems to be incredibly hard to construct. Right, so that's one. The other thing is that that if things like position and momenta are not fundamental, then you can ask the question, well, then how do they come about? Right, and I thought that is also a question that immediately has an influence on how one should think about quantum gravity. And I thought that was very, at first, important in this, if you think about sort of gravity in this operational way. And the third point, which is this part here, which is that it actually has some impact, some real impact, that actually ultimately gives you gravity, which is this. But so I don't know, that's why really I sort of got interested. So that's what I care about, is that third part, if you want.
So the question, well, I think many of the older members of the audience, they will not be reminded of the measurement theory of Danieri, Leuninger, and Prosperi, who I think in the early 1960s proposed exactly what you said about quantum measurement theory. And for reasons I'm not sure of, this theory has fallen out of favor. And it may be that, in fact, individual measurements are not explained in that way. I mean, technological precision has increased, and I think quantum systems can be isolated so well that the randomness of measurement outcomes has been proved not to be caused by fluctuations in the environment. Are you aware of this?
No, of course not. No.
And one computer talks about observing single photons and single electrons.
Yeah, but I mean, okay, so, but then, I mean, you don't see them, that's the language you put on the thing that you do, right? But ultimately, you do have some, there's always some big apparatus at the end, right?
But there's apparatus even at the classical level. I mean, you don't use your naked eye to see these things, you use some microscope or something, even for classical observations, right? And when you go down to a more refined regime of experience, you have to have even more sophisticated apparatus. So there's no contradiction in that, it's the same process.
The same process?
I mean, you're just extending your sense perceptions by using technological means. And as your technology evolves, you're able to do it better and better and probe into other regimes of experience. That otherwise, I think it's the same process.
Yeah, well, I mean, if it is, then I've not said anything. What I'm saying is it's not. That there's this, because our classical world is really this set of very different quantum states. There, when you go from one to the other, you naturally at some point will encounter this transition. That's what I'm saying. And the point, so, I mean, it's sort of a fluid, it's not a hard boundary, which I think is sort of good, right? It's this kind of boundary of that you encounter in solid state physics, where if you make a system too small, you lose sort of certain phenomena. It's that kind of thing. And so if really there's no transition anywhere on that scale, then I'm wrong. Then I'm just wrong. I don't know.
Allow me to throw an experimental example in the mix, maybe in the spirit of the back of the room comment. In ion traps, the way that measurements are typically done, and what they're measuring here is the internal state of a single ion between a D and an S state, typically, is by fluorescence detection. And you can do this by shining order of a dozen photons onto an ion. And if it's in the right state, then those photons all fluoresce and you get a pulse of a dozen photons out, which is enough to see with the naked eye. And if it's not in the correct state, then they don't. You can prepare a superposition of these states. Now, the only thing about this entire apparatus that is big in any sense is, first of all, the laser that produces the photons, but that is pretty easy to argue that it's irrelevant where the photons come from. And second, the track holds the ions. But again, the track is just sitting there as a place to put the ions. So I think this is a pretty conclusive example of a quantum measurement where we can show that we have a superposition, and the only macroscopic object that's relevant is the observer, him or herself. And yes, your eye is macroscopic, but if we start arguing, well, you know, that we're cheating because that's large, it's almost a non-falsifiable proposition, because how can you ever imagine a non-macroscopic observer, right? I mean, we're all macroscopic. So I guess my point is, this seems to be a pretty good example of a collapse, right? It certainly looks like a collapse, where there's no big object.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I would say the eye. Yeah, that's it.
So first of all, a comment and a question. So first of all, I mean, I think I agree that just from a philosophical point of view, it seems crazy that you should derive a more fundamental theory from a less fundamental theory. Certainly, the mathematical process of doing that can't be something deep. It's just something that we use because we don't have something better. So quantization seems like a very odd process. In terms of this example where you get this computational attraction, aren't you assuming some kind of classical back variables like the lattice? The thing you regard as position is measured against this lattice.
Well, in this, to make all these things sort of work, I'm sort of in this quasi-static thing.
Can you imagine doing it without that? I mean, hands on something that you can now, you know.
There are two things, right? So one thing is that this is just so that this it will be sort of more complex, because if you enter a non-static regime, then you will immediately move beyond this Newtonian thing, right? Because the change in the vacuum will also just sort of propagate through the system through the same term that I put up there. So it's not just Newtonian gravity. The system is only sort of Newtonian in this very simple limit that I put up. So what I'm saying is that this is, I'm quite fine with just sort of some lattice.
So I guess I'm just trying to say it differently. So at the end, you end up identifying something that you call the classical variables. In this case, the position is one example. The relative position is one.
Yeah, I mean, there are these things like R that I put up there, and stuff like that. Yeah, that was only non-problematic in this one.
But whatever that thing is, you have to map that back the way through to your fundamental theory, where it went from classical. We should didn't provide an example of here, because you did have something still classical in the fundamental theory. What I can't envisage is how you could even do that if you don't have anything classical in the fundamental theory. So if you just got some wild sort of crazy quantum stuff, why don't it just exist a headlogical bottle map you could have through to the classical?
Yeah, I'm not trying to understand. The system you have some ground state or something like that. Is there anything classical there yet, or no?
Is it ground state plus a lattice?
Then you have
kind of some position.
Right, and the meaning of position comes from the excitations that you use to define the position. Right, this is sort of stuff that I didn't sort of expand, but so this stands where sort of nothing moves fast and stuff like that. You can forget about that, and there's something. You can sort of take this God's eye view and analyze this theory like that, and then there's sort of this nice connection. But the point is that it goes beyond that.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
Okay, so I can start to see how you might do that.
So
you look at the properties of quantum states within there, and from that you extract something.
Right. How they interact. That's right. So, for example, the light construct just comes from the excitations with this linear dispersion relation that you choose to that are the lights of the linear system. And that's a physical way to say what how relativity comes about. So it's sort of, in a sense, it's sort of similar to how Lorentz found the Lorentz transformation, right? But just looking at the Maxwell equation and just asking, well, how would I, given that my theory is like this, is like Maxwell's equations, what would I actually be able to measure? And then you found that, well, there's going to be the shortening of routes and all this stuff, right? So it's sort of this physical notion. And it's what Harvey Brown would sort of try to, I think, get at in his latest book. Looked at that.
You know, sometimes I find this rather, I mean, this is just rambling. You see, this is an operational way of building physical laws, right?
Right.
And geometry and all that, right?
Right.
So it would seem that in the absence of matter, physical laws did not exist.
Did
the laws of physics exist before the universe was created? If so, how did a Big Bang create it?
Well, good. So, I mean, there's one thing which you could say. So you have some system, right, and it chooses some ground state, and that ground state might have certain effective laws, if you want. And then you could imagine a situation where had this system settled on a different ground state, it might have different laws. Right? That's what you're saying, essentially. Right? That's your question.
Yeah. That's sort of different. Some people believe that the universe was created through a Big Bang. In other words, the laws of quantum mechanics operated before the universe was created.
Right.
So the laws of physics operated before there was matter in the universe. That's sort of difficult.
Well, I mean, so the point here would be that I think the main point is that ultimately what you're saying is that you don't care so much about the spins, sort of the spin level of these systems. You don't really care about that. But it could be anything in the details of that thing. You can never verify anyway. Probably we won't be able to verify. Right? But this point of view could still be fruitful because you can think about situations like this, since you speak of cosmology. You could think of situations where you ask, well, let's assume that the system wasn't always in this ground state, but it sort of found it at some point it went into the ground state, right? So it made this. How would that look from far away? What would be the remnants of that phase transition in the future? So stuff like that, right? So you could actually sort of generally think about things like geometrical genesis, if you want to call it like that. And you could ask, well, what would I see? And so that's sort of, it's sort of interesting. And basically the point is that you could ask such a question, even if you say that probably you will never know what was ultimately the underlying theory, right? You could assume that some reasonably generic assumptions about the underlying theory will give you some sort of information about the.
Speaking of Genesis, I'd like to go back to the very beginning of your talk and your definition of classicality.
Right.
It seemed like the core of the project is saying that it, to be classical is to be to have a sort of inertia. Right?
Yeah, to defend your classicality is sort of the main point. It's to have a property and to correct.
That sounds a little circular. I mean,
no,
it's to defend stuff, to be robust against something. I was wondering if you could go back and maybe state a little bit more rigorously what it is.
Yeah, so I don't have much more to say there. So, I mean, this is this thing that people call generalized rigidity. So generically, what you have is if you something like this, right? So if you want to change, if you locally want to change your order parameter, your system will will react to that, will not want to have that, and that's all there is. So basically, the way to model that is to say that F, the free energy in this ordered phase, depends on this field theta.
But globally, though, I mean, so the entire Hamiltonian is rotationally symmetric.
No, the point is that if you take this table or something like this, right? So then you have sort of locally the position of the lattice site. So if you want, if I could globally move the whole thing, then since ultimately the Hamiltonian is translation invariant, that can't do anything, right? I mean, that's ultimately the reason why I have sort of excitations at the advantage for large weapons. But the point is that locally, it does care.
So does this rely on being a genuinely translationally invariant Hamiltonian? Because then that requires the system size to be literally infinite.
Well, I mean,
I'd like
good approximation to or something like that. Right.
I suppose, in particular, maybe here's what's bothering
me. I mean, the bigger the system, the clearer that effect, if you want. Mm-hmm.
But I can have a spin chain like this, very large one, and the ground state is degenerate, right? It could be pointing in any direction.
Right.
So I take a big look.
That's the point, yes.
And cool it down.
Right.
And I would, in fact, create a superposition of different states of the kind that you'd call classical. Right?
Yeah. So the point here, oh, good. Okay, so in the Hilbert space, there are these states. They're clearly there. What I'm saying is that it's very unlikely to get them. That's what I'm saying.
And why?
Because of the when you do this transition, then it will be sort of this last little fluctuation in your environment that will decide which one it is. And that I mean, you will get sort of some imprint of that fluctuation. There might be sort of this theta might be smeared a bit or something like this one. But essentially that will choose which one you will have. That's the point, if you want. So the point is that yes, there are superpositions of classical states in your Hilbert space. You just won't get them. And I agree. So this is something that is not very clear here.
It's a degenerate manifold itself, right? And so there are many states that are all ground states.
That's right.
And what would pick out a particular one as opposed to a superposition of them, right? And a superposition of ground states is also a ground state.
Yeah. So any fluctuation will do anything. That's a thing. Right.
But there are some systems that are robust in this sense, but that really have quantum system, like topologically ordered system. I mean,
right.
Like this is what you're explaining here. You know, is the reason why a hard drive is stable, right? It's an error correction code. So if you make local fluctuation, they just feel on.
Right.
So zero stays at zero. But these topologically ordered systems, they have robust quantum states. So maybe you need to refine this notion.
Maybe.
Because
maybe you can tell me about these things.
Okay. Yeah, sure. I mean, so what you were telling to Ron, I agree with that. But there are systems that would not.
Yeah, please. Yeah.
So, different question. So, if this is in some sense a problem of finding a theory of quantum gravity. How quantum would gravity be in this case? So, in particular, would you have something like a superposition of different causal structures? Yes, a superposition of different space times or.
Yeah, so, I mean, yeah, in some sense, yes. Because, I mean, so if you think about the. So it's, as I said before, the light cone would be given by your. The photons that you use, and so you get you sort of inherit some uncertainty from the fact that these are quantum things. So as quantum as the things are that you use to define I mean, in some sense, this is the first actually fuzzy light cone that I've seen in quantum gravity.
Again, those of us who are workers, we know of certain works by. Well, then this looks like Progressi, for example, on quantum gravity. This is actually, it's not that old, it's about 20 years old. Okay. When he tried to build in the uncertainty principle into the very fabric of space-time, and then derive quantum gravity, I mean, not just quantum gravity, field theory, quantum mechanics, and all of that from there. I mean, so there have been attempts in this direction.
Yeah, good. So I guess I have to collect sort of a whole bunch of things. I don't know. I don't know that part.
Yeah, I can give you a bit of this.
And another question related to that. So in these models, you have this sort of this background lattice. And then you kind of hope that
doesn't
fail. Don't be able to see that.
Yeah, which I mean, well, so this
have life. I mean, isn't there a huge challenge? For example, you saw that it would violate Veritas and like this. It would be some kind of absolute frame. So how likely is it that you won't see it?
Well, I mean, this so that was the thing, right? So that's where I was always sort of confused. So I thought that the question of asking, well, how does the system actually look from the inside is an interesting question. But I always thought, well, hold on, you can't use a system like that. Somehow the lattice might show up. And I always thought that so far I don't have an actual good reason why it shouldn't. But I think if this argument is right about the classical object and the Newton's law, what I showed you, then you see that the thing that you get is actually not trivial. So that's the best indication I have for that thing so far.
More questions? So I have one. People simulate easy models on the computer. Has any of this been observed?
No.
They see condensation regions that attract each other?
No. I mean, the point is, look, so the point is this, that, I mean, why might I be able to do this? Right? All the people have looked at systems for a long time. The point is that usually what a condensed matter physicist does is he's happy if he can go from one level to the next. Because that's usually an impossible task. Right. So what I'm saying is that you get magic if you get two of these impossible tasks. So what I'm saying is that if you find the ground state of any non-trivial Hamiltonian, it's essentially impossible. We know it for a handful. Right. Nobody can actually. If I write down for you the Hamiltonian describing a bucket of water, right, I give it to you. It's easy enough, right? It's some you can't find the three phases of water. Right, so the point is that usually what condensed matter physicists do is that they talk about one of these things. So they're happy if they have a good description of the spectrum of excitations. Right? Does it have a gap? Doesn't have it? Is it gapless? Whatever. Right? That's what you want to know. But I'm saying, okay, now take the next step, take these excitations, and go to the next level, solve that problem too. Look at the bound states of these objects, and then in that so these sort of two levels is impossible. It's just impossible. So numerical simulation clearly will not get you anywhere. Sort of for the whole thing.
More questions? Let's tackle it here.